Hi, this is Fiona Thomas and I'm a journalist at New Zealand Doctor. At this year's college conference, there were two David Haslams presenting, each of them from the UK and each of them GPs, working in other areas too. I spoke to each of them. This is the second of two podcasts, this time speaking to David W. Haslam, GP and chair of the UK's National Obesity Forum. Him and I sat down backstage at the conference, with the hum of the exhibitors hall in the background, to talk about what GPs can and should do about obesity. Okay, so we're sitting here in the backstage at the college conference this year in Dunedin in the town hall, and I'm sitting here with David Haslam, who is going to introduce yourself. Can you tell us where you've come from?
Yes, I'm Professor David Haslam. There are two Professor David Haslams here, and I'm one of them. And I'm a GP based just north of London in the UK. I'm a bariatric physician and I'm clinical director of the National Obesity Forum, which is a charity we set up in primary care to improve management of obesity and improve awareness of obesity.
Great, well it's great to have you here. You gave a fantastic presentation this morning. I think it was really something GPs were interested to hear about, because obesity of course is a huge problem for doctors. Do you see that in the UK as well?
Oh yes, it's identical in the UK. We're not quite as obese a nation as New Zealand is. New Zealand's apparently third in the world. I thought we had a fighting chance of being third in the world in the UK because we're the biggest in Europe, but you've beaten us hands down, I'm afraid. But it is something, yes, we need to do something about it, because we know, and it's often talked about, that obesity in itself is less important than the diseases that obesity leads to, such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, sleep apnea, arthritis, depression, fatty liver, the list is endless. And so we know the statistics from studies like Look Ahead and many others, but that when we have an obese patient in front of us, we let them walk out through the door without doing anything about it. So patient comes in with a rash, they've got an obese abdomen, and so we know, we can predict that they'll have a heart attack or get diabetes or get arthritis. We know what they've got in store for themselves throughout life, yet we allow them just to go away and we do nothing about it. And so I think this initial idea of identification of obesity and then engagement there, and then it doesn't have to take time, it can be very quick, just check the blood pressure, do a blood form, get them on the scales, it can take a minute as long as you follow it up, or get a practice nurse or someone else on the team to follow it up. The raising the issue of obesity is often said to be extremely difficult. There couldn't be anything simpler than raising the topic of obesity. We've all been trained and we've all had to work in casualty and tell a mother that her baby's dead, or a wife that her husband's just ridden his car up a tree, or that someone's got cancer. Now they're difficult. That needs a lot of training and a lot of guts to be able to do. Telling people we're carrying a bit of extra weight. Mums do it to each other in the playground, dropping the kids off whilst they're shopping. So if they can do it, we can do it, and we should do it.
And you talked a bit today about the type of build that people have in what you're looking for, and it was in particular this abdominal weight, people with skinny arms and
skinny legs and pot belly, and sometimes they fall beneath the threshold of overweight because it's just an isolated area of obesity, and I think we shouldn't be fooled by that. And I think the two pieces of equipment we need to identify obesity best are our eyeballs. And if somebody looks as though they've got a weight problem, they've got a weight problem. It doesn't matter if the scales tell you lies and say the BMI is 23. If they've got obvious signs of abdominal obesity, they need treatment. And we're just not doing that as a profession.
So what do you think, obviously, in a practice, for an individual doctor, it's the talking about it and it's the bringing it up. But is there anything else that you think can change the fact that we're not doing enough about it?
Yes, we should do more about it. I mean, we are rather relying on outside agencies, by which I mean Public Health England or the Health Promotions Agency or the government or schools and the health authorities. You know, we're relying on them to change the environment, you know, to do something about fast food restaurants, to do something about school meals, do something about sports in schools, and we can't, in primary care, we can't do that. That's not our job. So often I think when I've successfully managed a child for his or her weight, and the time's come to say, right, well done, we, you know, what a fantastic job, I feel like I'm releasing a wild dove back into the wild. And, you know, if it happens once, it can happen again. And so until those changes are made, we're looking after the obesity epidemic one person at a time.
And yeah, I mean, the environmental issues are huge, aren't they? I mean, you put up a picture of the heart attack burger, or what was it called?
The Heart Attack Grill in Las Vegas, downtown Las Vegas. They serve the Guinness Book of Records highest calorie burger in the world, which is around 10,000 calories. And they have three types of burger: the double bypass burger, the triple bypass burger, and the quadruple bypass burger. And so if there's a world like that out there, and that could just as well apply to the local chip shop or the local takeaway or the local candy store or the local bakery, you know, they're different ends of the spectrum, but they're still to blame.
Hmm. I guess for GPs that's daunting, isn't it? I mean, that's a world that a GP doesn't have a control of, but the GP has some level of control within their practice, presumably.
Yes, we can't deal with the overall environment, but we can deal with the individual. So getting a long-term result can be daunting, to use your word, but the educating of methods to maintain different nutritional programs and physical activity programs, it can work, and if it doesn't, well, at least we tried.
I was speaking to one of the GPs, Chris Reed. He lives up in Northland, and he asked, what would you do, basically, to get New Zealand, or in your case, perhaps the UK, down from that position, you know, down to 30th or bottom of the list?
In a way, we know everything we need to know. We don't know everything about obesity, but we know enough. We know what causes it, we know how to treat it, we know about diets. And low carb is always my favourite, my first choice for patients. We know about diet, we know about lifestyle, physical activity. We've got drugs, not very many, but we've got some effective medication. We've got bariatric surgery, which I'm a great proponent. So what we need is money, resources, political will, to change all those outside environmental issues. In the UK, we've had some programs set up with a minuscule amount of money, you know, pathetically small amounts of money, and for only a short time, and then they're stopped. And lo and behold, nothing whatsoever happens. So it's got to be done with a kick. Mm. It's got to be done meaningfully. So it's going to cost money, but in the long term, it'll save money. So the accountants won't like it for that year's budget, but in the long term, it'll work. So with those changes, and as I say, there's no rocket science about the changes that are needed. You've got a list of 22 different interventions in your recent childhood guidelines and policy document. No point just listing them, just do them. Mm. It's going to cost a lot of money, but it will work. And if you want to stay at third in the list and get the bronze medal, then do nothing. But if the government really wants to do something, just pour money and resources into those interventions.
Do you have any thoughts on a sugar tax?
Yeah, I'm all for it. We've got one supposedly coming up in the UK, but they're prone to change their mind on these things, so it's not done till it's done. But yeah, I think a sugar tax is a good thing. I think ultimately that should lead to a refined carbohydrate tax, because it's the same stuff as soon as it hits the bloodstream. So yes, I'm all for it. Mm. All for it. Mm. You know, it's the refined carbs, they're the problem. It's not the, you know, the thing about fat. Fat, if you eat an egg which is full of cholesterol, we don't inherit that cholesterol. If you eat prawn. A prawn is full of cholesterol, which is bad news if you're a prawn, but we don't inherit the cholesterol from that prawn. We get cholesterol from the refined carbs.
I wondered if you would be happy to talk about what you did with your son?
Yeah, my son Ed, when he was 11, he was a big boy. He had a real weight problem. He was quite active. So one day he was having his, we had tea down at the pub actually, and his favourite food was ham, egg and chips with peas. And he would always eat the chips first, like any other child, and then the peas, then the egg, then the ham at the end. And I said to him, Ed, do me a favour, next time eat it in the reverse order. Eat the ham first, then the egg, then the peas, then the chips. And that bit of dietary advice took less than 10 seconds, and sure enough, he did that. And immediately, he ate the ham and everything else, but he left the chips, didn't want the chips, he was full. And so immediately that very afternoon, he felt so much better, so much more energetic. He didn't have the carbohydrate sedation that you get with refined carbs. And so every time, whatever he has, he comes to the carbs last, and doesn't bother eating them, so eventually he just doesn't bother ordering with the carbs. And now he's 17, he's fit as you like, fit as a flea.
It's interesting because people always say, oh, it's hard to keep up with those diets, they work really well for the first X amount of time, but they're hard to keep up, but I think you said you sort of disagree with that.
I disagree with that. I think it's true in a lot of cases. You know, you can't keep fasting diets up. 5-2 diets, I'm all for them, but I don't think you can keep those up forever. These liquid-only diets, you know, the shakes and so on, you can't keep those up. But low-carb is more of a lifestyle change. You can keep it up. I started on it 18 years ago when I had a medical when my first child was born, and they said, how much do you weigh? I said, 14 and a half, always have. 14 and a half stone, I don't know what that is in kilograms, and they said 17 stone too, and so I thought, oh dear, I better lose some of this, and so I tried the low carb because I'd just been researching it a little bit, and here I am 18 years later, and I've worked out with the natural gain in weight across the population, I would be 25 stone, and as it is, I'm about 14 and a half as I used to be.
I mean, is there one right solution?
No, it's horses for courses, and not everybody does well on the low carb. One of the things that's said a lot amongst the research community, who don't see patients, is that a calorie is a calorie, and it doesn't matter what it's a calorie of, it's just a calorie. And I so disagree with that. I think that's so wrong. The definition of a calorie is the amount of heat that it burns off if you incinerate it. And so by that definition, yes, a calorie is a calorie, but it's so naive to think that the body deals with a calorie of gin and tonic the same way as it does a calorie of cheese or a calorie of steak or any other sort of calorie. So the problem has been in a lot of studies that they give isocaloric diets. So they say you will have 2,000 calories of high carb, you will have 2,000 calories of high fat, beg your pardon, you will have 2,000 calories of protein, and we'll see what difference there is in your weight. Well, of course there'll be no difference because they're all having 2,000 calories. The point is that if you have a low carb and an ad libitum diet, i.e. you're eating low carb, eat what you like, you're eating low fat, eat what you like, then the low carb people will eat far less, because they're much more satiated by the fat and the protein. Now, the thing about fat is that it's vilified, and I think that's because fat is found in the most terrible places, like processed meat sticks and, you name it. You know, high fat can be, you know, kebabs and burgers and real rubbish food.
Is there anything you would pass on to GPs other than what we've talked about? New Zealand GPs and the battle against obesity?
Nothing that I've not already said. We can deal with the individual, we can't deal with the world out there, and we should do our best to do that. We won't always succeed, but at least we'll know we've tried.
Great. Well, look, thank you very much for joining me.
Not at all.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.